From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Why is it that stories about nature are almost always pretty? Nature magazines and documentaries feed us gorgeous pictures of wild animals in remote landscapes, along with essays about protecting unspoiled places. There's nothing wrong with that, or is there?
That type of nature writing that most people associate with the genre is really a writing of privilege.
Today, a new movement aims to expand the boundaries of nature writing. In fact, to rethink the very definition of nature, to include toxic waste sites, blighted neighborhoods, and the politics of geographic segregation. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder explores the wild places inside us all.
The wild areas of the mind are the less visited places, the less obvious places, the ones that challenge you, the ones that you cannot quite figure out why it went that way, to remind us that we don't even know what our next thought is going to be.
David Gessner wants to change the way people write about nature. Instead of stereotypic stories about wild animals in pristine landscapes, he advocates a style of nature writing that's messy, raucous even, and includes an often overlooked animal, people. Gessner's latest book, My Green Manifesto, is an example of this new movement in nature writing. It's the story of a kayak trip he took down Boston's Charles River with his friend Dan Driscoll, a guy who spent years trying to clean up the river. And Strange Champs asked Gessner to read a passage from the book.
We paddle quietly for a while on the green, shadowy river. I listen as Dan launches into the first of the morning's monologues. Nature is my religion, he begins. He talks in this vein for a while, but when his words start snaking their way to the topics of activism and politics, they become bold and original. We nature lovers are hypocrites, of course, he says. We're all hypocrites. None of us are consistent. We worry that if we fight for nature, people will say, but you drive a car, or you fly a lot, or you're a consumer too, and that stops us in our tracks. It's almost as if admitting that we are hypocrites lets people off the hook. I pull my paddle out of the water to listen. What we need are more hypocrites, he says. We need hypocrites who aren't afraid of admitting it, but will still fight for the environment. We don't need some sort of pure movement run by pure people. We need hypocrites. I think of Ed Abbey fighting for the West while throwing empty beer cans out the window of his truck. I think of my own environmental Achilles heel, a dainty preference for hot baths over showers, not nearly as cool as Abbey's boozing, but possibly as wasteful. And then I think of everyone I know and can't come up with anyone who has an entirely clean eco-slate, which seems to mean that logically, Dan is right. If only non-hypocrites are going to fight for the environment, then it will be an army of none.
David, is this something you worry about personally, whether your own lifestyle measures up to your environmental beliefs?
I do worry about it. I come from a background of excess. A big family of big spenders and big eaters and big drinkers. When I first read Walden, the love of beautiful places resonated. What resonated less was this kind of frugality and pulling back and restraint, which just temperamentally wasn't a good fit for me.
So the subtitle of your book is Down the Charles River in Pursuit of a New Environmentalism. It sounds like you're beginning to suggest that we need an environmentalism that's less pure, more full of contradictions?
Yeah, you know, what we need is an environmentalism that's openly not afraid of being occasionally hypocritical, a limited environmentalism, a sloppier environmentalism, hopefully a funnier environmentalism. I mean, we all know the different nature languages. There's the nature saint. Oh, a squirrel, an acorn, how beautiful, how wonderful. And there's the technocrat kind of a semi-palmated plover, which migrates through in late October, you know. And then, worst of all for me, is the end-of-the-world school of just doom, where, no, you know, I say it's like living with a spouse who's always saying, this marriage is over, this marriage is doomed. And it's not that I disagree with the premise, because I realize population is rising, species are dying. I mean, the world is becoming more crowded and smeared with our industrial stains. It's true. But what I object to is kind of the result of focusing so much on the doom, which is the intellectual equivalent of a panic attack. You feel overwhelmed and you don't do anything. We become paralyzed, and the way out is by simple single actions. Hmm. And that's why I put Dan Driscoll, who greened the Charles River, as kind of a hero, because he didn't save the world. He saved a small part of it.
So tell us about Dan Driscoll, this guy whose conversation you just quoted in that section you read. He emerges in your book as a kind of modern-day eco-hero. Who is he, and what is it you admire so much about him?
Well, I met him in an unlikely way. I played Ultimate Frisbee for years, and there was this kind of crazy guy who we called Danimal, and he was known for racing after Frisbees, I said, like a border collie, and diving after them, and he was very full of gusto. And one night, drinking beers with him after we played, I realized that he had spent the last 20 years fighting to green the Charles River. It seemed a very unlikely guy to have done it when I first met him.
This is the river that runs through the heart of Boston.
Exactly. It runs from about where the marathon starts in Hopkinton right into Boston. It wends around. And Dan had taken a job as an eco-advisor for the state, working for the state in Massachusetts. And he had been the new guy, and they'd given him basically an impossible task. They'd said, you go reclaim this land along the Charles, and you clean up the Middle Charles. And, of course, the Charles River is so famously dirty, the Standells had a song, Dirty Water, about it, that they sing at Red Sox games. And Dan didn't know that he was given an impossible task, and he started in on it. What he was trying to do was reclaim land that had once been the state's. People thought they owned this land, that Dan was coming to tell them, no, in fact, the city owns it, and we're going to take it back. Just imagine the fury. You know, not in my backyard. He literally was trying to take their backyards from them. He had a legal team that he didn't use, not a single lawsuit. It was through town meetings, through cajoling, through schmoozing, that he managed to talk towns into putting bike paths along the Charles. And bike paths were kind of his Trojan horse for putting in native plantings and replanting the banks.
But it's really interesting that you write about this kind of eco-hero in your book when you also say that you're not sure you really want to be this thing called an environmentalist.
Yeah, I know what I do want to be. You know, if you look at Thoreau, who everybody drags out for everything, and I do too, I'm as guilty as anybody. I went back to Walden with my wife and daughter a couple of years ago. My daughter was about six. And we walked along the pond, Walden Pond, and my wife pointed and where the foundation, where the cabin had been, and she said to my daughter, that's where the house was of the man who ruined Daddy's life. And, you know, and it's true.
And
when I was 16, I read that book. You know, something changed. I was like, it wasn't that it was a literary thing. It confirmed an instinct in me, almost an animal instinct, that I loved those places and I loved mucking around in them, and I love being out in them. And it was a very kind of primal thing. And what frustrates me about environmentalism is we talk about laws and rules, and we neglect that initial Thoreauvian impulse of kind of wildness.
It sounds like you think we've tamed Thoreau, kind of turned him into a PBS nature special, and environmentalism along with it. And what we need is something more akin to, I don't know, the energy or the anarchy of hip-hop or the punk movement.
Yeah, well, anybody who's spent time more than a day or two out in the outdoors knows that around a campfire, usually with some sort of bottle that you're drinking from, you have some of the most raucous, fun, and funny times in your life, and you bond with people. And it's not pristine and it's not sweet. It's more like embracive of the whole. What I like to try to do, and what I've tried to do in my own life, is mess things up.
I'm wondering if one of the things you're suggesting is that in order to get more wildness into our environmental ideals, maybe we need to go on a kind of quest in search of more personal interior wildness. And then
I'm
wondering
that.
What that would look like, what that would mean in practice.
Well, you're right. I think the corresponding wildness is an emotional state. It's an openness and vulnerability. In the book, I say the misconception is we have to go to Everest to have a wild moment. And then I bring up two moments in my life that were the wildest moments I have ever had. The first was the death of my dad, where I was holding his hand and I could feel his heart pulsing. He was pretty young. It seems younger now that I've turned 50. He was 56. You know, he died while I was holding his hand. I hadn't experienced such an uprising kind of wild feeling in me. I didn't experience it again until many years later when my daughter was born and I was there. And I remember beforehand all my friends saying, oh, your life's about to change, the implication being that it would become tamer. And in fact, that was the wildest moment I ever remember. It's a C-section, and you know, I say she came out bloody and triumphant. Having a child has continued to be a very, to me, seems a very wild thing if you're open to the animal aspects of it. I remember one time Hadley had some milk encrusted on her face. She was probably like one or two, and my wife licked it off, and I thought, ah, yes, there's there's what we need. You know, this memory that we're animals too, which with it brings humility.
Well, I want to end by asking you to read just a little bit more from your book, the chapter called Henry's River.
Sure.
And this is on page 183.
Let's get down to a simple question, a question befitting an address to graduating seniors. Here it is. What is the meaning of life? Let's start with one of Thoreau's answers. It's fairly straightforward. Fall in love with the world. But how does this translate into practical action? Maybe through the oldest form of recreation, the activity I'm engaged in at this very moment, walking. I should point out I do a lot of my writing into a microcassette recorder while I'm strolling. I'm sorry, but isn't that where a lot of it starts? With apologies to the yogis who are reading this, most of us don't have a taste for sitting still. Wandering off for no apparent reason may not have the environmental zing of low-carbon cars, but it too serves a purpose, even if that purpose sometimes seems purposeless. First of all, it's the best way to see the world, and I'm convinced that for most of us, it's when we think best, when our feet are connected to the ground. Thoreau said of going for a walk, if you are ready to leave father and mother, and brother and sister, and wife and child and friends, and never see them again, if you have paid your debts and made your will and settled all your affairs, and you are a free man, then you are ready for a walk. What the hell does that mean? It means that we spend the better part of our lives trying to be logical, trying to be practical, trying to follow through on our commitments and checking things off our list. But that sometimes, maybe once a day, we need to launch ourselves out the door and head to a place, both physical and mental, that we can call our own.
That's David Gessner reading from his book, My Green Manifesto, Down the Charles River in Pursuit of a New Environmentalism. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Who are your favorite nature writers? You can let us know by posting a note on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll go for a walk in Cape Cod and talk about nature writing by people of color. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Not far from Boston, Cape Cod is a spit of land that juts 40 miles out into the ocean. It's a famous summer playground for tourists, but there's another Cape Cod for the people who live there year-round. Among them is writer Robert Finch. For years, he's captured the magic of the Cape in essays broadcast on his local public radio station, WCAI. His subjects range from wood ducks and ocean thunderstorms to oyster fishermen and Cape Cod diners. 52 of these bite-sized essays were recently published in a collection called A Cape Cod Notebook. Steve Paulson went to meet Robert Finch near his home on the Outer Cape in the picturesque town of Wellfleet to get an insider's view of Wellfleet's distinctive ecosystem.
Everything you see here on this side of the river is part of the Cape Cod National Seashore. From the right-hand side, stretching all the way to the left, you see a line of dunes, islands, more dunes, another island, about a 7-mile stretch.
It's a windy day as Robert Finch and I stand on a country road next to the Herring River on the outskirts of Wellfleet. Every so often we have to step off the road to let a car pass by. This particular geological formation we're looking at, the string of small islands connected to the mainland, is called a tombolo, and it turns out it hasn't been here that long. When Thoreau wrote about this same spot 150 years ago, there was no tombolo. These were unconnected islands, and ships could sail right into a harbor here. It's easy to forget this landscape is constantly changing, but it's one of the things Finch likes so much about Cape Cod.
And it's beautiful. But of course, if you look out, one of the things you're going to notice is this enormous new house sitting right up on top of a dune. This one is so blatantly out of scale.
It's huge, to put it bluntly.
Enormous, it's enormous. I mean, the good effect it had is it finally got the town of Wellfleet to pass zoning laws affecting building within the National Seashore, limiting size, limiting footprint, so that a house like this will not be built again. And all I could think of, that this is such an American process. We have to have one or two disasters or catastrophes to make us act. We can't just do it in anticipation of something. We have to wait for something bad to happen, and then we'll act. So there it is. It's a monument to what we should have done years ago, but we finally did it.
Bob Finch follows in a long line of writers who've chosen Cape Cod as their subject, going back to William Bradford 400 years ago. Thoreau later became a touchstone for all writing about the Cape, and more recently, so has Annie Dillard, who still lives in Wellfleet.
I fell instantly in love with the place when I came here for the first time as a college student in the 60s. I just knew it was the place I wanted to live. It was the place I felt I should have been born. I knew I wanted to write about it. I accidentally got connected with the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History and began writing columns for them. But I'm not, strictly speaking, a nature writer.
Finch prefers to call himself an essayist who writes about sense of place, though as the co-editor of the Norton Book of Nature Writing, he admits he can't exactly dismiss the nature writing label. He's especially fascinated by the complex interplay between the natural world and the human world, and he's found Cape Cod to be the ideal setting for this kind of writing.
When I first got here, I remember somebody told me that there was not one square foot of Cape Cod that had not been altered by human action. Ultimately, I feel that we were formed by the natural world, not just in the obvious biological evolutionary sense, but psychically.
The wind picks up as we walk up the road to look at a dike and the opening where the Herring River pours into the marsh. Another example of how people have transformed this landscape. The dike was built over 100 years ago in an effort to block the tidal flow so developers could clear this wetland. It didn't work, but the dike drastically changed the ecosystem. Now the National Seashore, along with the town of Wellfleet, wants to remove the dike to restore the original salt marsh. Finch can't really complain, as he says, who can oppose a salt marsh? But he's not altogether happy about this restoration project. Even a man-made habitat can become something unique and even quite marvelous.
It is a brackish freshwater wetland system. Actually, that kind of habitat is much rarer on the Cape than salt marsh.
Finch says this river valley has its own beauty. It's full of flowering shrubs and the best blueberries he's ever tasted. But he points out that many of these plants are what are known as invasive aliens. Finch believes not every alien species should actually be considered invasive.
That's what interests me about the whole thing, is this human concept of restoration, which is a fairly recent notion, but has gained rapid currency. Everybody's for restoration. And my question is always, restoration to what?
Bob Finch gets his hackles up when people talk about nature in absolute terms, as if all native plants are good and all alien species evil. We walk up the road to a clearing, looking for refuge away from the wind. Under a pine tree, I ask him to read one of his essays about this coastal habitat.
Crab Charity. It's not every day you get a lesson in crustaceans and charity from the same source. The other afternoon, returning from Hyannis by a back route, I came to a spot where the road crosses a tidal creek several miles inland. I got out to look around and noticed a young boy perched on some rocks where the channel comes out underneath the road. He was about 10 or 11, red-haired and freckled. He was holding a dip net with a long handle and wearing rubber boots that were filled to the brim with water. As it turned out, though, his boots were not for keeping his feet dry. "What are you fishing for?" I asked. "Crabs," he replied, not taking his eyes off the water as it swept by. Blue crabs? Yep. At first I thought I'd encountered one of the last practitioners of the Cape Codder's fabled reticence, but suddenly he swooped his net down into the murky waters and came up with a small, struggling blue crab about 4 inches wide. The catch seemed to loosen his tongue. They start to swim through here when the current starts to flow in, he informed me. It's all muddy and crapped up when it's going out, but it starts to clear up now, and you can see them swimming along the bottom. You have to throw them back if they're less than 5 inches, or there won't be any left, but this one I'm going to keep for my science class. The boy gingerly began to transfer the crab from his net to the bucket. Not an easy feat, for the crab's temper, to use an old pun, is snappish, and its appearance is no less intimidating. Armed with two strong front claws, the crab has a shell that's drawn out into a sharp point on each side. To remove one from a net is like poking your fingers into a snapping, clacking pincushion. The purpose of his boots became apparent. We used to catch them to sell, he went on, but we only got 50 cents apiece for them, so I went into my own business, and I give them away to whoever comes along. You can have the next one I catch. I thought this was a refreshing use to make of a poor market, and hoped that local economic development councils would be glad to hear of this public-spirited example of free enterprise. Just then, some friends of his came canoeing through the culvert, and he went off to talk to them. I stood there, admiring his ability, his sportsmanship, and especially his eel grassroots knowledge of life in this creek. It's the kind of first-hand knowledge that comes from just messing around, and that no science class or textbook can teach. Here, I thought, begins the lifelong naturalist. Then, in the clearing water, I saw what looked like a large crab clinging to a piece of seaweed in the current. I called the boy over, and he crept swiftly down the rocks, swung his net down, and hauled up not one but two good-sized wriggling crabs. I could already taste the succulent crab meat for dinner. But the young philanthropist scrambled back up and raced over to his companions to show off his catch. Apparently, his recently formed crustacean foundation had been suddenly dissolved, and I realized that if I wanted crab charity, I'd have to begin at home.
Bob Finch suggests we go visit some clamshellers he knows, so we hop into his car and drive over to Indian Neck in Wellfleet Harbor, and then walk out onto the tidal flats. He's told me to wear sandals, where we're greeted by an army of small crabs scurrying across the mud.
These are fiddler crabs. Their distinguishing characteristic is this giant oversized claw, one claw on the male. And they're called fiddler crabs because they move the claw across the other claws if they're playing the violin. Close up, they look rather fearsome, and one of the three species here has a specific name, a pugilator. But it's all display for territory and for mates.
Further out on the mudflat, we meet Pat Woodbury, who's tending a bed of clams. He and his wife Barbara have acquired the rights to manage this particular bed of shellfish.
These are little necks. What we do is we get seed from a hatchery, and they go in these nursery trays for the summer. And then we take them out of the nursery trays, spread them in these 12 by 50 or 100 foot rows right in the sand, and then cover those with a net. And they spend 2 to 3 years under the net. At that point, they're adult size, and we harvest.
So their whole lifespan, they're just basically either in the tray over there or under the net?
Yes. The whole purpose of what we do is to protect them from predation.
So what's the art of this?
Strong back, weak mind.
25 years ago, Pat and Barbara Woodbury moved to Cape Cod from Chicago. Now they're two of the Cape's most admired shellfish growers, and they sell their clams to some of the top restaurants in Boston and New York. This morning, they had a last-minute order from a local restaurant, so they're out raking for a couple of buckets of clams. The Woodburys sort out the clams into two grades of sub-legal size, which they stick back into the mud, and four grades of legal. Different restaurants want clams of various sizes.
This is probably a little neck, the lower limit of a little neck, because it's about an inch across.
Shelling is the Woodbury's livelihood, but it's also clearly a labor of love. Barbara and Pat Woodbury, like Bob Finch, are the face of the new Cape Cod, people who moved to the Cape years ago and now call it home. In some ways, it's an old story, people falling in love with a place and then leaving their own imprint. If we're lucky, their presence makes the place richer and more vital. And in the Woodbury's case, it means quite literally growing new life.
When we get these from the hatchery, there's about 150,000 seed in a 5-gallon bucket. We would stock, say, a 100-foot row with about 70 to 80,000 individuals. By the end of the 3-year growth period, that's going to represent 8,000 pounds of shellfish. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty amazing conversion.
So can you make a decent living doing this, raising clams?
Well, we've been doing it for 25 years, so, you know. Let's put it this way. Both my kids are musicians, and I've encouraged them to do that as a more steady, kind of stable means of income.
Steve Paulson produced our story about the Cape Cod town of Wellfleet. You'll find links to the Woodbury Shellfish website and to Robert Finch's Cape Cod essays on our website at ttbook.org, where you can also see photos of Steve's visit to Wellfleet. There's a big question we're asking this hour. What is nature writing? Laura Savoy has some strong opinions on the question. She's a professor of environmental studies and geology at Mount Holyoke College and co-editor of the book The Colors of Nature. Savoy says too often nature writers focus on pristine wilderness and neglect the gritty reality of the places where people actually live. In cities, for instance, maybe even near toxic waste sites. And writing about these places means grappling with difficult questions about race and poverty. This is a personal matter for Savoy. As an African American, she's often asked, why is there so little nature writing by people of color?
I say, of course there is. There's a lot. I'm often asked the twin question, why don't African Americans care about the environment? And my answers to both questions are, well, one, yes, we do, and there's a lot of writing. Part of the problem, I think, is the frame within which nature and environmental writing is published. The frame is limited to the extent that it excludes culturally and ethnically rich and diverse voices.
So really what we need to do, you're saying, is redefine what is nature writing, not who's writing it.
Exactly. Redefine nature writing, beginning by redefining or rethinking what environment is and what nature is. I imagine environment very broadly, not just as air or land or water that we depend on or that we pollute, but as the circumstances, conditions, and contexts in which we all live our lives. So that definition falls short if you don't include the experiences of places that are exiled or degraded, migrant or urban, toxic or dispossessed.
I understand what you're saying, but mm-hmm. I think we have to start by recognizing what I suspect both of us know mm-hmm. is generally referred to as nature writing. It's somebody out writing about the glory of wildflowers in the Rocky Mountains. It is writing about going for a stroll through the stony New England countryside.
Right.
And that is nature writing.
That is nature writing. And there's more. That type of nature writing, or that nature writing that most people associate with the genre, is really a writing of privilege, a writing of opportunity and choice. And there is so much writing about our place in the world or an individual's place in the world that's based on the lack of choice or based on poverty. And those stories are as important as moving into the wilderness, as exploring the natural world. But there are also elements of reclaiming one's heritage, of finding home or recognizing that home can be an urban garden that's carved out of a brownfield, but it is a place that you can claim.
So writing about that urban garden is just as much nature writing as writing about alpine fields.
I think so. Because where do we live primarily? Are we living in the alpine fields or are we living more in urban communities? And when I say we, I'm thinking of a larger population within the United States. But we don't need to go elsewhere to find nature. We can find it right here under our feet.
That, of course, is true for everybody. For
yes.
Specifically the subject at hand,
mm-hmm.
writers of color writing about nature. There are other issues. The one that you start with is New Orleans. New Orleans, especially post-Katrina, but you can't talk about New Orleans post-Katrina without talking about New Orleans as a whole, can you?
No, you can't. And I think you can understand the true impact of the breaching of the levees following the hurricane if you understand the historical context. After the Civil War, African Americans who had been enslaved and then were trying to gain access to find a home, they were only able to get the lowest line, least desirable places there, the areas that were flood-prone, that were mosquito-bound. And that segregation continued all the way through the 20th century. So if you look at the neighborhoods in New Orleans today, a geography of segregation still applies based on a geography of segregation that's more than 100 years old. And if you think about poverty and the ability to leave, to evacuate, so few people of color who were below the poverty line had cars, and mass transportation failed them. And so they were truly burdened by the historical legacy of racism, and on top of that, the disaster of the levees breaching.
Isn't the writing about this issue political writing, sociological writing? Although I'm beginning to see that any writing about place is what you're saying is nature writing.
Any writing about place and one's relationship to place is a form of nature writing. The case in point of writing about wilderness areas as if wilderness areas are completely pristine or untouched really is largely an illusion. Because at the time that the national parks were first established at the end of the 19th century, and at the time that the idea of wilderness with John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, the first great battle for wilderness with Hetch Hetchy, at that time, land was being set aside as pristine at the same time that Native peoples were being removed from that very land and set aside in reservations. And I very much think that wilderness areas need to be saved, but we also need to recognize their origin and that they were not completely unpeopled or unpopulated land.
Of course, many people will be familiar with the names of John Muir and Gifford Pinchot. Are there other names that we should know, people who write about those issues?
Well, let's turn our eyes back, if we can, to prior to the Civil War. African-American abolitionists were fighting against slavery, and at the same time, many of them were fighting and writing against the use of arsenic in tobacco fields. Over a century ago, two wonderful writers, Sarah Winnemucca, who is of Paiute heritage, and Zitkala Saw, a Lakota Dakota woman, both wonderful authors, noted the parallels between the racism that their people were experiencing at the hand of European or Euro-American settlers and the degradation of the land due to the environmental attitudes of those same settlers. The close parallel, the degradation of a people and the degradation of a land.
We have talked a little bit about the problem that Katrina caused in New Orleans. It's by no means alone.
Right.
We have people living in areas near hazardous waste because they couldn't afford to live further away from it.
And because the people who did live farther away from it and had the money and power to keep the waste sites or cement plants or you can name quite a few different polluting industries who had the power to put them elsewhere. You can think of Camden, New Jersey as a case in point. There's a neighborhood in Camden, New Jersey that does have a cement plant on one side of a playground and a waste disposal, well, an incinerator on the other side. And the asthma rates of the children who live in that neighborhood have skyrocketed, as has the incidence of cancer.
So, again, what you're really saying is that you can't even really think about nature without thinking about the politics and the sociology of it, but the cultural divide. When did this notion begin to change for you?
My work really has always been at the edges or the boundaries. In my education, from art to science, and then as a woman who is African-American, but also within African-American, also Native American, Euro-American. but not having access to those others because I'm labeled in one box. Check, she's black. When I was a little girl, I would say 4 or 5 years old, I had the self theory. We lived in California at that time, which is where I was born. And that is that sky flows in my veins and that sun colored my skin because I looked like sun in afternoon light, just like the California land. And that's what I believed colored meant. But then we moved to Washington, D.C. around the time of the 1968 riots. And I'm 7 turning 8, and I learned that colored has another meaning. And I learned when someone spat on me, tore my dress, pushed me into the mud, and called me nigger. And I realized that race almost trumped what I thought I was. I thought I was born within Earth. And I think growing up and coming to where I am now, it's been maybe an attempt to acknowledge how these two fragments, and they became fragments so in 1968, actually belong together.
Laura Tsavoy teaches environmental studies and geology at Mount Holyoke College, and she's the co-editor of the book The Colors of Nature. You will find links to several essays in the book on our website at ttbook.org. Next, award-winning poet and nature writer Gary Snyder talks with us about Buddhism and the practice of the wild. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Gary Snyder occupies a unique place in American letters. A Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, he was a friend and confidant of the beat writers. He inspired the main character in Jack Kerouac's famous book, The Dharma Bums. And he shared the stage when Allen Ginsberg first read his epic poem, Howl. Snyder studied Zen Buddhism in Japan for more than a decade before settling in the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California, where he's lived since the early 70s. Over the years, he's carved out a distinct literary voice in poems and essays about Buddhist spirituality and the natural world. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Gary Snyder to talk about animism, the meaning of gratitude, and what the poet calls the wild areas of the mind. They begin the conversation with a poem.
Paiute Creek is the first poem I ever wrote that I decided to actually treat as my own poem and keep. So it stands as a kind of a hinge in my life.
How old were you at that time?
25. I had already written a lot of poems, but I had quit poetry by that time. And so this is what started me again. Paiute Creek, one granite ridge, a tree would be enough. Or even a rock, a small creek, and a bark shred in a pool. Hill beyond hill, folded and twisted, tough trees crammed in thin stone fractures, a huge moan on it all is too much. The mind wanders. A million summers, night air still and the rocks warm, sky over endless mountains. All the junk that goes with being human drops away. Hard rock wavers. Even the heavy present seems to fail this bubble of a heart. Words and books, like a small creek off a high ledge, gone in the dry air. A clear, attentive mind has no meaning but that which sees is truly seen. No one loves rock, but we are here. Night chills. A flick in the moonlight, slips into juniper shadow. Back there, unseen, cold, proud eyes of cougar or coyote watch me rise and go.
Oh, that is wonderful. Thank you. You said that you wrote that when you were 25. Had you started studying Buddhism at that time?
Oh, yes. I already considered myself a Buddhist by then. I was working on a trail crew as a laborer in the northern section of the Yosemite National Park high country, completely out of touch with the rest of the world. After work, I would practice learning how to meditate and look at the stars. So this came to me one of those nights and was in some way transformative for me.
Hmm. Now, in the new preface you wrote for your book, The Practice of the Wild, you describe your own spiritual path as old-time Buddhism. And you say this is connected to the ancient traditions of animism and shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it raises the question, what does it mean to be a Buddhist animist?
Well, all of the Buddhists up to the 20th century were animists. Because the whole world is animist. That is to say, there is a special kind of life in all of phenomena. But this is never ideological. There are possibly spiritual forces and spiritual powers. The world only asks good manners of us, so we might as well have good manners and make a little bow here, offer a little rice or alcohol there. Say thank you whenever there's any reason to say thank you. That's what the ancient world did.
So what I'm curious about is clearly that ancient tradition has spoken to you very powerfully over the years. I mean, it's clearly had an enormous influence on your life. And why you've gravitated to that way of thinking, sort of this animist way of thinking, you know, seeing nature alive, sort of spirits out mm-hmm. there, as opposed to, say, Christianity, the dominant religion in America.
Well, dominant doesn't mean anything. My parents, as it happened, were atheists, working-class atheists up in the state of Washington, and socialists, and union people. And so they, you know, allowed me to go to Sunday school for cultural reasons and thought I ought to check it out. I went to a Lutheran Sunday school for a while. But I left when, this is a story I have to tell. We had a heifer on our little dairy farm that had died, and I asked the Sunday school teacher, will my heifer go to heaven?
what did your teacher say?
Well, the poor guy, you know, if he was a real theologian, he could have gotten over that. But he said no, so I quit. I said, if my heifer goes to heaven, doesn't go to heaven, I'm not going either.
So the animist goes way back in your own life.
It does indeed, yeah. I grew up in the woods, actually. And it was a natural thing to feel what was going on. But, you know, Buddhism has a very nice way of dealing with God and the gods, which is to say, oh, yeah, they're very powerful beings. We don't know much about them. We hardly ever see them. They seem to be there. None of them are perfect. Buddhism offers them a way to learn to meditate and become wiser.
I thought Buddhism didn't have any gods.
Well, old-fashioned Orthodox Buddhists are also animists, but they don't believe in them. They take an enlightened kind of funny skepticism, saying that we better have good manners toward them, but maybe they're not really there.
Now, I'm guessing that your Buddhism goes especially back to the time you lived in Japan, and I know you lived there for many years, from the 1950s to the late 60s, studying Zen.
That's right.
That must have been a very unusual thing for an American to do back in the 50s to go off to Japan.
At that time, there were not many other Americans, but it was hard then, you know, right after the war. 1956 is when I first went to Kyoto. Japan was still recovering from World War II. There was a lot of poverty. Nobody had a refrigerator, and it was a hard time for people. And so the monastery was particularly severe. It still is, actually.
Now, there's one thing I have to ask you about your Zen apprenticeship in Japan all those years ago. There's a story about how some monks dangled you over a cliff with a rope tied to your ankles. Did this really happen?
Well, it wasn't Zen. That was the Shugendo, or the Yamabushi. I went out with them. I was already a climber, you know, before I went over there. I had done a lot of mountaineering in the Pacific Northwest. Climbed most of those big snow peaks along the West Coast. So the word got out that I had done mountaineering, And so one of the elders and monks at the monastery I was connected with, the Daitokuji Sodo, said, well, you ought to go out with the Yamabushi. They took me up in the mountains, the Omine mountain range, and part of their way of inducting people into their particular society is actually no rope, hold your feet with their hands and hang you over a cliff, and then ask you questions, and they say they'll drop you if you don't tell the truth.
Were you scared?
Yeah, sure. But, you know, I trusted them. And I was sure they couldn't tell if I was telling the truth or not, so.
What kinds of questions did they ask you?
Oh, I shouldn't talk about that. Ah. I wanted to say one thing about animism. In the Zen monasteries and in the Buddhist temples, they have a number of little shrines around the place. They have the main Buddha hall, but in little corners here and there, they have shrines that are to the earth goddess, for example, the Lord of the North Star. And once a month at the monastery, the monks, we would tour all around the grounds and stop and do little services at each of those small shrines, like the Earth Goddess Shrine, and then go back into the main Buddha Hall. That's what I mean by etiquette, by good manners, by taking account of all the possibilities.
Do you still carry on some of these kinds of practices in your life
today? Oh, sure. I chant sutras every morning, and I meditate every morning. Once you start doing that, you don't quit.
And what about these kinds of daily thanks? Do you do that kind of thing as well?
I say grace at every meal.
What does grace mean to you?
First of all, it simply means gracias, to say thank you to your food, to the people who helped make it available, and to the living beings, both vegetable and animal, that are now on your plate, wishing them all well and showing appreciation for what they've done. That's what grace always is, everywhere. It's saying thanks for the food and acknowledging that other beings are feeding us, that we live on the lives of other beings.
Now, you've also written a lot about the idea of wildness. And maybe we need to start with a definition here, because wildness is not exactly the same thing as wilderness, is it?
Wild means process, when human agency is not involved. That's all. It's quite simple. What is a wild dog? How is a wild dog different from a domesticated dog? A wild dog feeds itself, is independent and free, and has another set of problems and necessities that it has to deal with, but it's not getting its food from human beings.
You have a wonderful phrase in one of your essays. You talk about entering into the wild areas of the mind. What are those wild areas?
Well, let's take it in as parallel to the physical wildness in nature. There is the territory in your house and around your house and your neighborhood, and the paths and roads by which you go to work and come back every day, or go to school and come back every day, that are familiar to you. And that is your domestic world. But then beyond that is the territory of where a wild process is dominating, and that requires different skills. You often go in there on your own and by yourself. So the wild areas of the mind are the less visited places, the less obvious places, the ones that challenge you, the ones that you cannot quite figure out why it went that way. And, you know, to bring it right up close, to remind us that we don't even know what our next thought is going to be. Our ability to manage our mind is very limited. And this is one of the things you learn when you meditate. Meditation is like cutting off all of the outside stimuli, no music, no painting, no conversation, and seeing what your mind does when it's really subject to your full attention. And there are parts of it that you will find yourself going into that you've never been to before, which is like the wild.
Are you partly talking about art here? I mean, is that part of the wild areas of the mind, creating art?
Part of art is partly wild, I'm sure. You know, the French anthropologist Levi-Strauss had a nice way of putting it. He said, he was talking about Europe. In the modern civilized world, he said, art is like a little national park of wild mind. Well, you know, anybody who works as an artist knows You can train a dog or a horse to do certain things. You cannot train a poem or a painting to do certain things. You have to leave a lot of openness to what it tells you to do. Listen to that. Go along with it. You can control language when you want to be a scientific or a highly organized prose writer. When you're writing poetry that's getting seriously good, you can't control what's being said. You have to listen for it. The human ego, will, rational mind has its limits, and art is beyond those limits.
Could we end with another poem?
Okay, here's a little one called They're Listening. I'll read it, and then I'll tell you the story behind it, because it's so short. Mm-hmm. As the crickets' soft autumn hum is to us, so are we to the trees, as are they to the rocks and the hills. Somebody gave this the title, They're Listening. So the poet who disappeared, committed suicide probably and disappeared, Lou Welch, and I were sitting by a campfire one night in summer up in my place in the mountains back in the early 70s, taking our time, chatting with each other and not saying much. And then he said to me, Gary, do you think the trees pay any attention to the human beings? And I said, gee, Lou, I'm not sure. What are you driving at? And he said, well, us human beings, we're just passing through. So I took that little thing, which I loved, and made a little poem of three stages. As the cricket's soft autumn hum is to us, so are we to the trees, as are they to the rocks and the hills. So that's three stages of time scale.
Yeah. And we forget that. We so often think that we are somehow central to the story of this world, and maybe we're just a blip.
That's Steve Paulson talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder, who brought his dog into the studio for our interview. His many books include The Practice of the Wild and The Etiquette of Freedom. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, go to our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show Writing Nature, number 116B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Sarah Nix. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will find shows and interviews available to stream, download, and share with friends.
PRI, Public Radio International.